Revelation chapter 4, verse 11. We have a scene of worship in God's throne room, number 23. John hears the 24 elders sounding forth praise to God the Father who sits upon the throne. And so in verse 11, they say, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created." John in heaven hears God the Father praise as the Creator of all things. This claim, of course, implies that there is a living, personal, omnipotent God who created, who thus makes the rules for mankind. The sinful nature of man, however, rebels against the idea of any such supernatural person, and so it rejects this concept of God as the origin of all things. In determining the origin of all things, man is hindered by physical, spiritual, and mental limitations. When he rejects what the Bible has to say on this subject, he is tremendously limited. The worldview which one holds determines everything that you do, determines your whole set of values. Your worldview is determined by your concept of where everything came from. How you look at things is determined by your belief of where it all came from. The word for that is your cosmogony. There are two basic worldviews. One begins with the concept of evolution. The other begins with the concept of creation. Evolution proceeds to a human viewpoint, set of understandings, and one of the things that results is a cosmogony that is devoid of God. The other is a divine viewpoint cosmogony, which is based upon creation. The human viewpoint worldview is the one which most people hold. It has two primary characteristics. One is autonomy, that is, man views himself as totally independent of any superior being. He doesn't have to account to any source above himself. This is the basic thesis of secular humanism today. This is at the heart of the humanist manifestos 1 and 2, which very explicitly declare that there is no supernatural being above man. Man is the beginning and end of everything that has to do with his personal experience in life. So, man rejects the authority and the reliability of the Bible. Human reason and experience alone are used to guide him in his conduct and in his values. The other factor of human viewpoint worldview is idolatry. It always goes to idolatry. The true God is rejected as the reference point of the universe and on which man can build his decisions and experiences. So some feature of the creation is deified in place of God himself. Man himself is sometimes deified, as in the God kings of ancient times, or some feature of the creation itself, an animal, is viewed as a deity, such as rats and cows are viewed today in India as being gods. But no god of nature is big enough to account for everything that man sees. And so he uses another god called the god of chance to explain everything else. Whatever the particular god that he has made cannot handle, it's just the result of chance. The evolution base of the human viewpoint worldview is cosmic evolution, so that it includes not only the upward changes of one species biologically into another by sheer chance over a vast experience of time, but it also includes man's sociological, man's cultural development and evolution upward toward world peace and prosperity. This concept of cosmic evolution is the basis of modern economics, psychology, education, philosophy, law, literature, religion, history, sociology. All of these areas of human study are based upon cosmic evolution, that things are getting better and better, and man is moving upward in every way in all of these areas. Now, the human viewpoint use of available evidences regarding origins is the next thing we want to look at. There are evidences concerning origins. Now, how does the human viewpoint worldview treat the evidence? to determine the origin of the universe, man has to rely on evidences beyond his direct observation. You weren't there, I weren't there, there isn't anybody here who was there when it all began. Therefore, we have to deal with some kind of evidence that beyond our personal observation. This is what God reminded Job when he was speaking to him, that Job was not around when God was doing his creating work. Job chapter 38, verse 4. God says, "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding." Job 38, verse 4. "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding." So that pretty well put Job in his place of any arrogance that he may have had, of any opinions that he may have had. God was showing the relationship between the God who was there to see it, who could tell about it, and Job, who could not know about it because he wasn't there. And the answer to God's question is that Job wasn't there. So the question is, how objective and scientific is the human viewpoint worldview? Human viewpoint worldview, which is based on evolution, declares that it is very scientific and it is very objective. Now here are the sources of information out of which you have to build your worldview. And the reason I want to go through this, and in some details a few of the scientific facts, is because we in the fundamentalist biblical camp have been made to look like fools because we don't understand what the scientific world has been talking about. We don't understand what the opponents of the book of Genesis have been talking about. We have simply dismissed what they have said as idiotic, which it is, and have gone on from there. But because we have done that, we have left the field wide open to all those people out there who don't know that what the evolutionist says is idiotic. They are impressed by the claims to being scientific, to being objective. So you need at least some basic understanding on your own relative to what the scientist is saying, so that he doesn't bowl you over with his intelligent looks and his command of the language and the degrees and experience that he has. First of all, past historical records are available to us of things that have taken place in the past. We have records of past historical phenomena. First of all, we have verbal records. These are eyewitness records. Verbal records of eyewitnesses. Under those, you have the fact that the scientist historian must evaluate the record that is given relative to trustworthiness of the observer. So the first thing you have to worry about is trustworthiness. I have a record from somebody who is on the spot. He is giving me a report of what took place in terms of origin. And there are many verbal records, you understand, of origins. The ancient records that we have, archaeology is constantly uncovering records from ancient people who tell you where it all came from. We do have many ancient records, and I'm not just talking about the book of Genesis. There are numerous records from various cultures that tell you where it all came from. So these are people who claim to have been there on the spot and seen it. So we have to determine, the scientist historian has to determine just how trustworthy are these written records. Furthermore, the scientist historian has to interpret the meaning of those records. He has to look at these records and determine what they mean by some kind of proper principles of interpretation. For example, there are some people who take the book of Genesis and say, yes, that claims to be an eyewitness written record, but it is not an historical record. It is a myth. It is a kind of an object lesson. It is an illustrated story. It didn't really happen. And so you have to interpret Genesis so that you can answer the question, was there ever really a handsome young fellow walking around named Adam and a beautiful gal named Eve, and did they get together and create their own thing that resulted in a lot of other different things? Is that actually a point in time in history that all that took place? Is it real or is it just a myth? So Genesis is one of the primary written records that we have to deal with. If you're going to decide where it all came from, you cannot ignore the book of Genesis. Then we have also nonverbal records. That's a second category. Now both of these are past, so you get past historical records. From one place or another, these are records from the past that we do have, a phenomena which took place. So first we have various verbal records. Then we have nonverbal records. And that, of course, are the artifacts that archaeology uncovers and the rock strata that the geological studies bring to light. Now, again, we have to look at those artifacts. We have to interpret them. We have to look at the Grand Canyon, and we have to interpret the rock strata. We have to interpret what we see in the Grand Canyon and say, how did this happen? What brought this about? We have to look at all that geology has to say about various kinds of life forms which are found in different strata of rock. And we have to answer, how did those things come there? So there's an interpretation relative to those things, and then there's including in that interpretation is, how old are these things? What do these things mean? How old are they? And we reach certain conclusions that are based on certain judgments of reason from these nonverbal records that we have in the earth itself. Then there is a second kind of evidence, and that is, we could call the natural processes of the present. Natural processes of the present. Under those, we have basic scientific laws. There are certain basic scientific laws. We know these laws through direct and instrumental observations, such as the first and second laws of thermodynamics. These are basic scientific laws. Once the reformers established the Bible as the authority, they also established the Bible as the authority in terms of how the world was made. And so up to about 100 years ago, Genesis record of creation was the basis of man's understanding. Out of that Genesis record comes the fact that things do continue under certain natural processes, and you can count on them. It was because of the understanding of the reformers that modern science was born. Once you understood that there was a God who created the universe and that he locked it into certain laws which are inexorable in their operation, you can't get around them. There are laws relative to gravity. There are laws relative to heat and cold and so on that you cannot escape. They work every time. Now, if that's true, suddenly men discover, you know, we can learn things, and we can make these things work, and we can create things that will make life better for man because we know how the law works. It'll work every time. And so all of modern science and all of modern technology was the result of the reformers establishing the concept of creation that Genesis portrays, a God who made everything and made it to work according to certain rules, certain natural laws that he put into operation. So now when you're going to look at origins, you have to consider these basic scientific laws. And this is where Christians have been shot out of the water, because they didn't understand some very simple little things which every school child ought to know. So that when the scientist, the evolutionary scientist, hits you with all of the scientific data and all the jargon that he can slap against you, that'll pin you to the wall because you won't know what to say, that you should know at least certain basic truths, scientific truths, apart from the Bible, which will answer everything that that evolutionary scientist has to say. And two of the most valuable laws of science for you to know are these first and second laws of thermodynamics. This word thermodynamics comes from two Greek words. One is the word for heat, which is thermo. It's a Greek word, therme. And the second is the word for power, which comes from this last part here, which is dunamis. D-U-N-A-M-I-S. Therme, T-H-E-R-M-E. Putting them together, therme and dunamis, you get the concept that thermodynamics deals with the power or energy which is contained in heat and in its conversion to other types of energy. The laws of thermodynamics deal with the energy which is inherent in heat and converting of that energy to other types. Every ninth grade science class teaches its students that energy has the capacity to do work. And work is exerting a force through a distance. That is, I have energy in my body as the result of food capacity that is stored energy. I can push against this pulpit with that energy, and I am exerting energy. I'm not doing any work. Until I move the pulpit, no work has been done. But energy is capable of performing the processes of work. It is capable of changing things. Matter itself is one form of energy. When Einstein buttoned that down, the scientific breakthrough was made for the atomic age. Once it had been established that matter itself is energy, and if you can take matter apart, you will release enormous amounts of energy. Once that was established, the atomic age was born. So matter itself is one form of energy. So that everything in the real world is one form of energy or another. And all the processes that take place are simply transformations of energy from one kind into another. Now then, we have two laws that deal with energy. These first and second laws of thermodynamics, and these are recognized as the most universal and fundamental of all scientific laws. If ever there were two laws of science that have been established that there's no debate about, it's the first and second laws of thermodynamics. If Christians had known these two rules, then they would not have been so bowled over by the evolutionists and would not have been so shattered. The two laws of thermodynamics deal with energy. Everything that happens in the physical universe is some form of energy conversion. So the laws which govern energy and energy conversion are of primary importance to understand the world that we live in. So let's look at the first law of thermodynamics. This law says that energy can be transferred from one place to another, or it can be transformed from one form to another, but it can neither be created nor destroyed in what's called a closed system. This is not really complicated. The point here is, can anything new be created? This basic scientific law says that you cannot create energy. You cannot destroy energy. The world is like a box that's closed. It has so much energy in it. You can change that energy into different forms, but you cannot make more energy than what is in there, and you cannot destroy the energy that's in there. So the total amount of energy in the universe is constant. We say it is conserved. That's why this law is sometimes called the law of the conservation of energy. It's the first law of thermodynamics. Now, this scientific law is considered the most powerful and the most fundamental generalization about the universe which scientists have ever been able to make. Science cannot explain why the energy is conserved. They cannot explain why energy is neither created nor destroyed. But the reason is clear for the Christian. The reason that no more energy can be created in the universe is because the Bible has explained it to us. God, the living, personal, supernatural God who alone can create energy, has ceased from his work of creation. Genesis chapter 2, verse 3 tells us explicitly that God quit making energy. When he quit making matter, matter is energy, he quit making energy. God has stopped creating new power, new force of energy in the universe. So that explains why you can't create energy. But why can't you destroy energy? The reason that no energy can be destroyed is because God is also upholding all of his creation by the word of his power. Hebrews 1:3 tells us that God is holding it all together and maintaining it by the word of his power. So he is not creating more energy, and he's not destroying any of it. In Ecclesiastes 3:14, this principle is stated this way: I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. Now, that's beautiful. That's exactly the point. Nothing can be taken from it, and nothing can be put to it. Ecclesiastes 3:14 is an enunciation of the first law of thermodynamics, buttoned down right there in the pages of Scripture. So, today, nothing is being created, nor has it been since the first law of thermodynamics has gone into effect in the universe. Nothing today is being created. Let's look at the second law of thermodynamics. Second law of thermodynamics says this: there is in the universe a general process of change, and this process of change is always downward. Things run down like a spinning top. Nobody spins a top and expects the top to go faster and faster. He spins it and expects it to go slower and slower and slower. And every complex form breaks down. Everything that man builds in time breaks down. You can't clean up a room in your house without it breaking down into disorder. Even if nobody is there, it will accumulate dust, it will begin to deteriorate, it will begin to be eroded in one way or another. Everything breaks down. And I'm sorry to say, that includes you. All of you. You go uphill till about 16 years of age. When you hit 16, you're known as the over-the-hill gang, and you are deteriorating all the time. Some of you, obviously before our very eyes, are just coming apart, deteriorating. Becomes more visible from week to week. Some of you do your best to cover it up. You paint it up. You cover it up. You hide it with a lot of stuff. But we know what's happening under that cosmetic and that false front you're putting on. You try to do it the way you dress and your personality, but you're breaking down. This is that miserable, terrible law, second law of thermodynamics. It says that everything is going to disorder. It's all coming apart. It's all breaking down. For every naturally occurring transformation of energy, there is a loss of available energy to maintain the system. In a closed box, for every action, you lose some available energy. That is, in the process of doing work, some of the energy performs the work, but some of it is transformed into some form of energy that can never be used again. For example, heat. If you move a box across the floor, you have used up some energy and some of it is dissipated in heat and it's gone and you can never use it again. You haven't lost any energy, it's just been converted from one form to another form. The total amount of energy, the first law tells us, always stays the same. But the second law tells us that the amount of usable energy is getting less and less and less. And that's what happens to you in your physical body. The capacity of energy that you can maintain to keep the body going becomes less and less and less until it dies. The system is constantly breaking down. The top is losing more and more of its power to keep spinning. Energy has to flow from a higher level to a lower level. That is, energy will go from a hot body to a cold body, but it won't go from a cold body to a hot body. See, it always goes down and it's dissipated. There's always energy that's being lost in terms of being usable again. You can never recover it to use again. So therefore, no process can be 100% efficient where all the energy is being converted into work. You lose some through heat, that radiates out into space, it's no longer available. That's why a perpetual motion machine is an impossibility. You cannot build a machine that keeps creating as much energy as it uses up. Now, they had a program on television a few months ago where they had a man who said he had done it. He had made a machine that created as much energy as it used up. And he had everybody stumped. Had all the experts analyzing what he had put together, and they couldn't figure it out. He kept that light bulb burning, and the thing kept creating its own energy, and it kept burning. But he had a little hidden cord, a little hidden wire, that was kicking in a new supply of energy to keep the thing running. You cannot make a machine that creates as much energy as it uses up. You're always converting some of it into some form where it can no longer be used. So this law indicates that since the functioning of the universe uses energy, and some of that energy is made unusable, in time all the energy in the universe will be unavailable for use. All of it's going to be dissipated into heat energy, and everything's going to be at one low temperature, and there'll be no more energy in the universe. Now the first law tells us that the supply of energy cannot be created. It couldn't create itself. It can't go from no energy to energy. The total supply of usable energy in the universe had to have a beginning. We had to begin with a box full of energy to begin with. From some source, the energy had to be put there. The first law says you cannot create energy any more than you can destroy it. The second law proves that the total quantity of usable energy is decreasing. It's never increasing. You know, radioactive material is an evidence of that. Radioactive material is always being dissipated into inert forms, like into lead. Lead never goes back to radioactive. Radioactive always goes down to where it's not radioactive. Everything is always spinning down slower and slower. So the point is, this law tells us that if we go back far enough in time, we'll come to the point where the total energy in the universe was all usable energy. At some point in time, the second law tells us all the energy that was there was all usable. Since that time, the energy has been gradually decreasing. It's there in another form, but the form it's in is no longer usable. It's been dissipated in heat out into space. There it is out there, no longer usable, and so the Earth's capacity is getting less and less. When we come to the point where there is absolute total energy at maximum use, then you come to where the book of Genesis begins, that it was a God who is capable of making that energy and putting it in there. So the second law of thermodynamics declares that the universe is constantly getting more disordered. The human body breaks down. Now there is a temporary inflow of energy. Somebody here is going to come up and say, what about a baby? A baby gets more complex all the time. Begins with two cells, and that little simple thing becomes a very complex thing. True. But it is because there is an infusion by an act of God, again, of special energy that brings that about. And the infusion of energy to bring from simplicity to complexity, that baby, is a special infusion of energy. And at a certain point, it reaches its maximum, and then that baby's body, when it grows to a certain age, begins to go downhill. Crystals form from nothing to complex forms, but they also, in time, break down. It takes a special infusion of energy to do all those things. So that exactly proves the case that if you leave it to itself, it goes to a disordered condition. Everything collapses and wears out. Now this law is true of all the processes, including biological, geological, chemical, and physical. Now, you see the problem? Evolution calls for a gigantic increase in order and complexity from a single cell, from a single life cell. And the second law of thermodynamics says that cannot be. It never goes from simple to complex. It always goes the other way, breaking down. So, analyzing of the basic laws of science, the two most fundamental, first and second law of thermodynamics, is one that you have to consider if you're going to say, where did it all come from? You cannot ignore these two basic laws. Now, there's a second in the natural processes. There's not only basic laws, but there's a second factor, and that is secondary systems, we call them. Secondary systems have to do with the fact that there are certain chemical and mechanical reactions that take place on the basis of the basic laws. These processes have to be applied to the past in some proper principle. There are certain chemical things that are taking place now. There are certain mechanical things that take place now. And these have to be projected back out there into the past. This is the thing you have to deal with. Let's back up here for a moment. You're going to establish origins. You have to consider past historical records. These are verbal records, things that eyewitnesses have written. They're nonverbal, the things that you find within the earth, the archaeological finds. Then you have natural processes of the present. You have to consider basic scientific laws, and then you have to consider secondary systems that work from those laws, chemical and mechanical processes. Now, I don't care whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian, that is what you have to consider. That's all the evidence there is. There's nothing more. You're going to answer where it all came from. Now, what are you going to do when the historical records are contradicted by your present understanding of observable scientific processes? That's what the evolutionist says. He says that the scientific processes that he sees today contradict what the book of Genesis says. When that happens, you have to decide the trustworthiness of each of the evidence, the written record and the scientific processes. You must decide if a present scientific process is the same when you apply it to the distant past. And there's the secret. We don't know. We don't know that the processes, the basic laws, always operated in the past without interruption. As a matter of fact, we do know from the Bible that God periodically walks in and he interrupts the process. We call that a miracle. He periodically reverses a natural law. So that we don't know that the basic laws always acted the same in the past. You have to decide. If it is the same, you must determine the reliability of the historical record. Did the observers accurately report? If the book of Genesis is an accurate observation, then our scientific understanding has to be guided by that. No one can take a time machine and go back there to observe so you can speak from your own knowledge. But how are you going to interpret this evidence? Well, you're going to interpret it on the basis of certain personal presuppositions, religious presuppositions that you introduce. The interpretation that people reach is different on the same evidence because of their religious presuppositions. A human viewpoint, worldview, mentality is governed by his decision to be independent from God, his autonomy, and his idolatry, his self-deification. He deifies organic growth and chance in his human viewpoint, evolutionary worldview. So everything is interpreted by a supposed process of upward development. Now that seems natural to the human viewpoint worldview, that everything is going upward in the process. So all the evidence for origins from past historical records and the present natural processes are interpreted from that religious viewpoint. The twin gods, that everything is moving upward and it's controlled by chance. The human viewpoint mind rejects the accuracy, therefore, of the Genesis record of origins because it comes from an infinite personal God who tells us what happened before man existed. The Genesis eyewitness report is viewed as absurd because it conflicts with the religious presuppositions of the upward development and chance of the evolutionists. The book of Genesis gives a report that says man has gone downward, devolution. The presupposition of human viewpoint scientists says, I know that's wrong. I know from the fact that evolution is the truth that the Genesis record is telling us that man is going downward. That's wrong. Man is going upward. Things are getting better. And so he rejects the Genesis record on the basis of his religious presuppositions. The biblical view of a creator God is seen as just a past stage in the evolution of religion. The evolutionist says the biblical writers were simply imagining a non-existent God and furthermore imagining that that God was speaking to them. The biblical writers exaggerated natural events as if they were miracles so they could exalt their imaginary tribal God. So the historical record of the Bible is not to be trusted in arriving at a cosmogony, an explanation of origin. The fossil record has to be interpreted by the same religious presupposition, these nonverbal records. They have to be also treated in terms of these presuppositions of the human viewpoint outlook. It assumes that basic scientific laws have always remained the same. That's called the law of uniformity. You have to assume that basic scientific laws have always operated the same way. He also assumes that the complex systems that those laws have developed have always remained the same. That's called the law of uniformitarianism. The law of uniformitarianism says there could not have been a flood, because that would interrupt the natural processes of the natural laws. And therefore, the Bible must be wrong, because laws are always working the same in nature. Now, these two laws would indeed be reasonable if you didn't have the contrary evidence of the book of Genesis. The evolutionist has interpreted, according to his human viewpoint, religious presuppositions. He has not interpreted from scientific objective grounds. The human viewpoint priority of evidence is based on the presupposition of upward development and chance. So that here's the way the human viewpoint evolutionist looks at things. He puts, number one, the secondary systems. These present natural processes for him are placed number one. The basic scientific laws are placed with him as the first guideline to determining origins. And everything is applied to the past as if it was working in the past as it is today. Secondly, he comes to the secondary systems and he looks to those. He says, I know how those operate, and so those are the same. Then he comes over here in terms of the past historical records and he puts the nonverbal third in line, and last down the line, he puts the verbal records. He says the nonverbal records are to be interpreted by the presuppositions of evolution, and the verbal records, he said, those are just unreliable reports of superstitious observer. So the evolutionist, I want you to know, has arrived at his explanation of origins on the basis of his assumptions that things are always moving upward and that it is all controlled by chance. He has no other records, no other evidence to work on than you do as a Christian. But it's the way you approach that. You start with the laws that you see working today and say those laws are always uniform. They're never interrupted. You look at the secondary systems that arrive from that, the chemical and the mechanical. You say that's always the same. That's uniform. There's never any change. Then you come to what you see in the fossil record and you say that indicates that life is progressing from simple forms to more complex forms. You don't say those things were distributed as the result of the dynamic movement of a huge flood. The waters of the Noahic flood distributed various densities of materials, of life forms, in one way or another. You don't believe that. You reject that. You say that what this is showing you how it progressed from simple forms to complex. And you interpret the fossil record accordingly. So the evolutionist thinks he's being scientific and objective. But he's made several decisions on the basis of his human viewpoint mentality, not the least of which is to reject all of the verbal records, especially Genesis. So he hypothesizes, therefore, that there is some natural law that prevailed constantly to bring all this about. Now, you say, doesn't he know the first and second laws of thermodynamics? These two laws, certainly, are going to be a problem. What does he do with them? This one tells us you can't. The first one tells us you can't make or destroy energy. The second one tells us that there's less usable energy in the world all the time. So the result is that things always break down. Things never get more complex. They get less complex. He says, yes, that's true. I can't deny that you can't create or destroy energy. And I can't deny that things go from complex to simple forms. But, he says, I've got a hypothesis for that. I have an answer. I believe that someplace back in time, there was another law that canceled these laws. There was another law that canceled the second law of thermodynamics, so that for a time, simple things could develop into the complex forms that evolved into the various life forms. So he suggests that there's some kind of natural law that operates out in space, in the past. Or he says that law is out there operating today and it's causing the second law of thermodynamics to be overridden. But you see, that assumption knocks the props out from his own viewpoint, because he is in effect denying that all things can be explained in terms of presently observable laws and processes. And remember, that's what the evolutionist says. When he says, no, John is just making up that that God up there is the Creator sitting on the throne, he is saying that I believe that John is not telling the truth, because all natural processes that are functioning today have always functioned uninterrupted in the past, and that's how we know how things came to be. And yet, when he says something overrode the second law of thermodynamics, he's undermining and denying that very claim. He's really resorting to creationism as the answer, but without a creator to be subject to. He's trying to explain overcoming the second law of thermodynamics by some other force out there. One of the favorite is mutations. But mutations, everybody knows, are usually bad. When you get something that is abnormal, it's very bad. If you have a human being that's born with two heads, that ain't good. That's a mutation, but it's bad. And it doesn't make things better. And mutations are always like that. They degenerate the thing. If there's anything that mutations do, it only proves the second law of thermodynamics, that things keep breaking down. They don't get better. Sometimes they claim that the excessive energy comes from the sun, and that's what provides what evolution needs to keep going. So you got to have more energy in the system, because the top is running down. And so the sun is the answer to that. But what they're saying then is that evolution is taking place as a result of the infusion of the sun's energy throughout the whole universe, throughout the whole galaxy. So why isn't there life forms everywhere? This is the concept, that the sun is giving energy to override the second law of thermodynamics. That is the reason for the space exploration with the concept of finding life out on other planets. They're not just saying, I wonder if there's life out there. They're saying there surely must be life out there. Why? Because there's a big bolt of energy being put into the system to override the second law of thermodynamics that is forcing everything to break down with less energy working. It is a bolt to put into the system so that all of the universe should have creative life forms of one kind or another. And forms of life should be evolving everywhere. That's where the idea comes from. It isn't just some wild guess. So here's the conclusion. The first law of thermodynamics tells us either that the world has always existed in its present form, or else that it was specially created at some time in the past. The first law says you cannot create or destroy energy. Therefore, it tells us that the world at some time always existed in its present forms, or else it was specially created with the energy forms that it has in the past. The evolutionary scientist says that matter is eternal. And incidentally, all of the ancient stories about origins of ancient cultures, they all begin with the universe in existence, just like the evolutionist does. They never begin like the Genesis record does, with a God who is there and nothing else. So that what comes then is as a result of the act of that God, independent from that God. That's interesting, that all the ancient myths always begin with the universe that's already there. That's what the evolutionist does. But the first law of thermodynamics has to tell us that it always existed, because you can't create energy, so it had to always be there, or else somebody did create it at some point in time and provided the basic supply of energy. The second law of thermodynamics tells us that it cannot always have existed in its present form, or else it would already have been completely disintegrated and have died. The universe could not have existed in its present form always, because it would have been gradually coming down, and it would have been long since disintegrated. So it does tell us that at some point it started with energy that was totally usable. a huge amount of totally usable energy. So the universe must have had a beginning, and that beginning must have been by special creation, the power to have brought it all into existence and set it in motion. Now, while this is scientific, this is what keeps Christians from looking like fools. If you can anchor your understanding to the first law of thermodynamics, the scientist has to respect that. You can't make or destroy energy. So where in the world did it come from? You can't make. It can't make itself. Where did it come from? Secondly, every process of life uses up energy. And as energy is used, as processes of life go on, and all the natural forces go on, it causes things to decay. There is the second law of thermodynamics, the law of decay is there. And you cannot escape that law. So therefore, evolution is just the opposite of decay. Evolution required that at some form what happens in a mother's womb was taking place all over the universe. That there was something, an infusion of energy that was making things get better and better. And of course, the evolutionist says, yes, out there something overrode that law and made that possible. But that is a sheer unadulterated guess. That is not scientific and that is not objective. And so when somebody says that to you, you can say, okay, you can go ahead and believe that that's the way it happened, but please don't call that science. You can't prove that in the lab, and therefore it's not science. And don't call that objective. That's your personal opinion. But as we shall see when we look at the divine viewpoint foundation of the worldview and what a Christian from a divine viewpoint worldview bases his conclusions on in terms of the natural scientific laws and the record of Genesis, you suddenly come up with a picture that all fits together. The part that we don't know, because we haven't got a time machine to go back there, God provides for us in Genesis. When you put that together with these two laws, it dovetails perfectly, and you see that this is exactly the way the thing worked. A creator God put together a universe that had the capacity of energy. Then man came along, Satan came along, sinned, man followed him in sin, and into motion came the second law of thermodynamics, everything degenerating and everything moving toward decay and death. And the Bible confirms that that's exactly the way it happens. So if you understand that, you're not going to be bowled over by all the technical data and information and other concepts that can be thrown against you as a Christian, so that you hunker over and you just slither away and you slink away because the evolutionist has been able to make you look bad. It is when our children are taught these scientific facts in school and matched up to the records of Genesis and then to the other position, taking these same evidences, and we both have to deal with these same verbal and nonverbal and scientific evidences, that any kid in school, when presented these two, who thinks it through, will almost inevitably say, the evolution is impossible scientifically. It can't have come about that way. And that is the reason for this battle of trying to keep out scientific creationism from the public schools. Because the public school administrators know that the evolutionary concept will be made to look ridiculous when you match it up against the first and second law of thermodynamics and the Genesis record. You put those three together and you come to a worldview that places a living, powerful, separate, personal God at the head of everything, and man's autonomy is crushed and man's idolatry is made to look like the foolish, stupid thing that it is. Christians should know the ground of science sufficiently that they are not intimidated by the brilliant men of our age who do not enter into spiritual understanding, and their problem, their incapacity to enter into it, and the reasons for that we'll look at in more detail next time.